got what Adam craved when he, with love for Eve, was tortured. She only had an apple tree, but you've got an orchard. You got those ways, those taking ways, that make me rush up to Cartier's for a wedding ring. You've got that thing.
When your life's a busted bubble and you've lost your chance, don't run and get your gun. Go into your dance.
Now you point your toa, then you fix your boa. Now start to turn, again you turn, again you turn, again you turn. Now for a finish, be strong, again you turn. That's the chorus of the hot potato.
So hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 26, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Peter, you kept the world safe for the drama desk last week, didn't you?
Yes, indeed.
Excellent.
Don't thank me. It's just on job description. Yeah.
Well, welcome back. And Michael, you are going to be off next week on a trip to Washington, D.C., where you're going to, I'm so jealous, you're going to see Ragtime at the Ford Center. What else is going on?
At Ford's Theater, yes.
At Ford's Theater, excuse me.
And then also a new musical called Midwestern Gothic at Signature. So I'm really looking forward to
it. Is it a vampire musical?
No, but I think it's got some rather dark elements to it.
It's been a few seasons since we saw a good vampire musical. All right. So just a reminder out there that last week we talked to Rick Pender, the executive editor and publisher of Everything Sondheim, and we've had a lot of great response from that, and so has Everything Sondheim. So if you are a listener and you missed last week's chat with Rick, check that out, because Everything Sondheim is such a great publication and we'd really like to support them.
And on that note, I just now was on Facebook and someone was, I think they messaged Rick Pender and said, I'm Rick McKay, and said, do you know what is up with Sandra Church? I've always wondered about her, and I always love her on the Gypsy album and blah, blah, blah. And so I think Rick knows her, and he replied something. But then I wrote, well, as it just so happens that there is an extensive interview with Sandra Church in the first issue of Everything Sondheim. And then I also said it's also available on the website for subscribers as premium content, and I put the link in. So I just thought that was, coincidence that someone happened to ask about Sandra Church, and there's this huge extensive interview that goes into everything, her conflict with Merman and all of that stuff. So it's all in there and it's all great.
Excellent. So we'll have a link to Everything Sondheim in the show notes and check that out as well. First up, Peter got over to 54 Below and saw a presentation of Rachel Lilly Rosenbloom and Don't You Ever Forget It. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this was a musical that had planned to open in 1973, and it didn't open. Oh, it did play some performances, but it didn't open at the Broadhurst Theater. And it became rather legendary. In fact, it's mentioned in many books for one reason or another, including the fact that Sondheim went to see it on closing night, and the author Paul Jabara begged him not to go into the theater because he wasn't happy with what had happened. But Sondheim prevailed and went in. Now, what I learned the other night. This is a show I had no idea about per se. I mean, I had to glean what I could from clippings here and there when I was writing about the biggest hit and the biggest flop of the season, because this was the biggest flop of the season. What was so funny was to find out that at one point, Rachel, and I'll get to more explanation on Rachel later, is approached by a man who says, "Oh, you remind me of my nurse Maria." And he starts singing, "Maria," you know, and I wonder how Sondheim reacted to that at that point in time. Was he amused? Was he furious? Who knows? But he's the one who got in there. Well, I finally got into 54 Below to see it on Monday. Jennifer Ashley Tepper and Rob Schneider, who does Broadway's Living Legends, did it twice on Monday the 13th. And doing it twice was really 29% of the Broadway run, because they only did 7 previews. So once again, this proves old musicals never die, and they don't even necessarily fade away. So it was originally written for Bette Midler, and I wonder what she was thinking, since she's right down the street. I guess here was her second chance to be in it, but she was a little busy, so she couldn't do it. One of the big things made of it is that Rachel is a heavy-set woman. When she was born, she was 17 pounds, 4 ounces. So I wonder if the incessant mentions of weight was one of the reasons why Bette Midler decided not to do it. Of course, another reason might very well be that she didn't like the show. Ellen Green, best known as Audrey One, shall we say, wasn't heavy. And I don't know if she wore a fat suit, but she wasn't heavy. So, but she wound up with the part. So I wasn't sure if the narrator they used, very Rocky Horror type of narrator, was actually in the script or something they just did for this concert presentation. But for the record, it did have a narrator that night. Anyway, Rachel works at the Fulton Fish Market, which she claims in lyric is just a stop on my way to the top. She reads movie magazines and watches TV incessantly. Well, okay, but that brought up the first flaw of the evening, because suddenly Glinda shows up and asks if Rachel is a good witch or a bad witch. And, well, I'm sure that all of you out there recognize the line, but for some reason, this incessant reader of movie magazines who's always watching TV doesn't catch on that this is a character from The Wizard of Oz. Wouldn't you think she would? Well, anyway, Glinda's going to help, because Rachel lives in her parents' basement, and her parents are just driving her crazy, saying, "All you do is sit around and listen to show tunes." A refrain I used to hear my parents make all the time through my teen years, by the way. But anyway, so a stolen American Express card gets her to Hollywood, where an uncertain pedestrian, she's uncertain pedestrian. She doesn't know which way to turn, literally and figuratively. And she's hit by a car. And the man who hits her is the guy who sings Maria. And he's very interested in her. Of course, one of the bad things of the show is there's that tired joke of people never getting her first name right. You know, they might call her Raquel, Rebecca, Roseanne, names like that. And Raquel, she gets so used to hearing that she actually changes her name. Of course, the big joke at the time was that she spelled her name not in the conventional way, R-A-C-H-E-L, but R-A-C-H-A-E-L. And she claims she took the other A from the A that Barbara Streisand dropped from her first name, which is B-A-R-B-R-A as opposed to B-A-R-A. I don't know. I've seen a lot of Rachels with A's towards the end of the name in recent years. In fact, one of my editors at Masterworks Broadway, in fact, has an extra A. I've never asked her if the inspiration was Rachel Lily Rosenblum. I guess it wasn't, but you never know. Anyway, so she goes out there and she's going to have great success, she's sure, but she winds up working as a maid for this famous Hollywood columnist, Stellar Star Fuckoff. That's the name. So so anyway, there's a lot of talk about drugs, and I thought Platinum in 1978 was the first Broadway musical to mention the word quaalude, but no, apparently not. So just shy of 5 years earlier, Rachel Lily Rosenblum mentioned Quaaludes. So there's a lot of talk about drugs. And Kelly Bishopland told me that this was the woman from Chorus Line, Sheila, told me that she, when she was in this show, she never saw drug use like ever. The cast was just, and the staff were just going crazy on drugs. So maybe that's how Quaalude wound its way into the script. Who knows? Anyway, the music. Well, there's a tribute to Broadway that sounds like most every other one, but that was Paul Jabara's clear intention. Otherwise, it was standard, but often melodious, to be fair, pop rock. Very listenable. It may have been a very different type of Broadway musical, but it had the component that so many Broadway musicals have had. Second act trouble, because once Rachel takes over Stella's business, Stella dies. You know, Rachel is now this important columnist, but she's not happy in her personal life. That old story. So the show doesn't so much end as it does stop. I mean, you know, it seems like after about 2 hours, they just said, okay, we've given enough entertainment. I'm talking about the original production. I don't know what happened in 54 Below. But what we have here really is the first camp Broadway musical. And I always suspected that if it were produced today, when there have been so many camp musicals, that it would do substantially better. And especially with the clowns who like to go and mock musicals. I think they'd have a hell of a time at this. But back then, it opened between Gigi and Lorelei, which are very different types of shows, as I'm sure everyone will admit. But I think it might do a little better. I don't know if it would make back any money, but I do think it would do well. I really have to take my hat off to Bonnie Milligan, who played Rachel Lily Rosenblum. She was really, really terrific. Also, Julia Madison, Estella Starfuckoff, was very good as well. So I also enjoyed Anastasia McCleskey as Glinda, who does figure into the plot slightly. So, you know, I don't know if it was that we've been through so much junk in the ensuing years, but it didn't seem that terrible. A masterpiece? Hardly. A good show? Hardly. But certainly on its own terms, entertaining every now and then. I'm not the least bit sorry I went. And I do think that there's a possibility somebody in that audience said, you know, this would be a good off-Broadway show. So we may not have seen the last of Rachel Lily Rosenblum.
I wonder if it'll ever make it into the encore rotation. So, Michael, you got over to the City Center Encores to see the New Yorkers. So tell us about that.
Well, talk about old musicals never dying. This one was, I guess, a real resurrection. The shows that Encores has done have been in various states of whatever, disrepair. You know, some of them have been in better shape than others in terms of the surviving materials. This one, 1930 musical with music and lyrics by Cole Porter, book by Dorothy Fields, based on a story by E. Ray Getz and Peter Arno. And apparently, it really, a lot of it did not survive, especially in terms of special material. And in addition to the Cole Porter songs that he wrote for the show, Jimmy Durante was one of the stars, and he brought in some of his own material, his comedy material. Also, Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians, that group was in the show, and they did some of their own stuff. Apparently, the show was sort of a almost a half a review and half a musical. The plot is so inconsequential and ridiculous, I'm not even going to expound on it at all. It involves prohibition and upper class New Yorkers mingling with the sort of gangster types and all of this mayhem and stuff. So anyway, this show required more work than a lot of the other shows that Encores has done. And in a note in the in an article in the program, in the Playbill, Jack Viertel, the artistic director of Encores, details all of that. And he freely admits that they did more than they normally do. They could not have presented a really accurate recreation of the original, even if they wanted to, because so much is lost. So they thought they would just add their own, some of their own things. And they said that they did find some of the Durante stuff, but they didn't use all of it because they thought that it just couldn't fit in properly. The end of the first act is this nutso number called Wood, W-O-O-D. It doesn't have maybe – it does not have the sexual connotation you might think, but it's just a total non sequitur. Comedy number, brilliantly done by Kevin Chamberlain in the what was the Durante role, and his two cohorts in the show, who I really have to tip my hat to because they were so great as far as the style, the comic style of the 1930 that they recreated, Clyde Alves and Jeffrey Schechter. These three guys were just amazing. By the way, there were some other songs from other Porter shows thrown in as well. The only one I agreed with a friend of mine who said the only one he felt really did not need to be added was Night and Day, because that is so famous on its own that it just seemed kind of like it stuck out like a sore thumb in a good way in terms of hearing the song, but just didn't really fit. The rest of the cast, absolutely fantastic. Cyril Aimé doing an unbelievable, fabulous version of Love for Sale. Clyde Alves, I mentioned. Todd Buonapane. Arnie Burton, absolutely hilarious. Kevin Chamberlain. Melinda Hull. Robin Herder. Byron Jennings. Eddie Corbett, just fantastic. Tam Mutu. Jeffrey Schechter. Scarlett Strallen, who I... I think she's actually going to maybe become a star on the basis of this production. She got fabulous notices and deservedly so, and she is really amazing. And then the last two of the featured people were Tyler Lansing Weeks and Ruth Williamson, whom I've always loved. So it was a really great, great thing to see. You may never see it again. It would be fabulous if they can record it. We know that's not as easy as it used to be at Encores for various reasons, but I think that would be really great. And it was just so delightful to experience that kind of crazy, off-the-wall, vaudevillian-type musical comedy. I adored it, and it seemed like the audience did as well. Directed very well, I should say, by John Rando. Music director Rob Berman, who again did a lot, a lot of extra work, and choreography by Chris Bailey. So that was The New Yorkers. As usual, at Encore is only a 1 week run, so it's now part of history. But like I said, maybe they'll record it. That would be really fantastic.
A couple of observations here. One, you mentioned Night and Day. Mel Miller's Musicals Tonight is doing Anything Goes.
Yes.
And what shows up at Anything Goes, I think a show that's been played with more than Zero Mostel, even played with Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. there's Night and Day all of a sudden. And the strange thing is it's paired with All Through the Night, which is from Anything Goes originally. And the Playbill song listing actually says All Through the Night and Day. That's how the song is listed. And they're done together. And it's rather impressive to see them done together and matched so well. Whether or not you like the idea, the Night and Day should show up in Anything Goes. Michael, I saw The New Yorkers too, and I thought it was terrific. And I would have preferred seeing The Real New Yorkers, as much as I love songs like Most Gentlemen Don't Like Love, right. A song I'm crazy for. I would have preferred seeing The Real New Yorkers, and they did what they could. Andrew Barrows, who did a production back in 1994, gave them the materials that he had, and that turned out to be very, very important to their making the show happen. So But I thought it was delightful as well. And it was very nice to see Arne Burton, who I've seen in so many shows, plays, though, suddenly have a musical comedy turn and make the most of it, even though his song didn't come from the New Yorkers either. But let's face it. I don't mean let's face it in the sense of let's face it. I mean, there was a show called Let's Face It, and the song came from there. So, but the choreography was really sensational, and so were the costumes. And once again, we're reminded that Encores is no longer by the book, literally, in the sense mm-hmm. that people are holding scripts. I mean, these are really productions now, and yes. The only thing that's really missing of any type is scenery, but otherwise you get everything that you could possibly ask for in these productions. They are productions. So I'm delighted you liked it as much as I did, too.
You know, it's also true of musicals tonight that they no longer
use
script. And I think I'm not 100% sure. I think what happened in both cases was that maybe they added literally like one or two rehearsals, and also they may have renegotiated with the unions, and I think that was enough to allow, you know, because it used to be theoretically a union requirement, really, that they would have to hold the scripts if they had fewer than a certain number of rehearsals. But it really does make a difference, you know, just psychologically. And it's I had discussed last week, Peter, about Night and Day showing up in Anything Goes.
At, you talk about that. Okay.
Yeah.
Good production, don't you think?
Oh, excellent. And it's so funny because there were other songs in the musicals tonight, Anything Goes, that were not written for Anything Goes, but were shoved in. And then next week, they are doing Du Barry Was a Lady, which, of course, is where Friendship originally came from. So between Du Barry Was a Lady and the New Yorkers at Encores and Anything Goes at the musicals tonight, I've just been ODing on Cole Porter, but there are worse ways to go.
The irony is, in the second act of The New Yorkers, they talk about friendship, and suddenly the actress turns to us and says, you know, we could do a song about friendship, but it doesn't come from this show. And yet they're doing songs from other shows. So, I mean, you know, it's sort of a funny remark that they're breaking their own rule there. So
that's great. So unfortunately, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, you've missed it already. It did play, as Michael mentioned, just this week, March 22nd through the 26th at the City Center. So hopefully somebody is able to make a recording of it to get it out there in case you have missed it. Next up, Peter and I got to Lincoln Center to see How to Transcend a Happy Marriage. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Well, I do think this is Sarah Ruhl's best play, but I don't like Sarah Ruhl's plays. So so that may certainly impact on what's going on. So story of two suburban couples having a decent enough time at a party, but somehow the subject turns to sex. And before long, well, the sex gets a little hotter than they expected, and things start happening. Now, one of the reasons start happening because there's a catalyst, and that is a temp in our leading lady's office. Now, I don't know about you, but I had a very, very, very hard time believing that if a temp came into her boss's house with her two boyfriends, by the way, and by the way, to be fair, the wife knew that she had two boyfriends. But I still think it's a little hard to swallow that if a temp came into her boss's house, that she would be so forthright and forward and start the conversation about sex and eventually making it lead to they're all having a good time. So that was strange to me. And I don't know why it wasn't the case that she used to be a temp in the office, because that would be a very different set of circumstances. She'd have nothing to fear. So anyway, what happens is that the host's daughter comes home and sees what's going on, and it really freaks her out. And she decides to run away from home. Well, a lot happens here, but I do think the speech at the end is very, very potent when the mother says to her daughter, this is not a quotation. I'm just summarizing. You know, it's just so sad when you have a child that you're thought of in completely different terms, that your sex life is considered over. You know, your kids don't want to think of you having sex. All those issues, you know, which are really good points. And I really thought that they packed quite a wallop. Robin Wiegert plays Jane. That's the woman of the house, and does it extraordinarily well. Marissa Tomei is part of the couplings, and we see it mostly from her eyes. Her character name is George, and for when the show started, I thought, whoa, is this a transsexual? I just wonder if she's transitioning. Her name is Georgia, but everybody's always called her George, so that's the end of that. Lena Hall, who we know is a Tony winner from Hedwig, plays Pip, which has nothing to do with Great Expectations, even though she has great expectations for the evening. She's the temp, and she's the one who gets things going. So I do think the message at the end somewhat redeemed it for me. But otherwise, I thought it was just a standard variation on the when two couples start having sex with each other. I didn't find anything new there. It was only the speech at the end that really made me say, oh, okay. You know, very sit-throughable, by the way. Not painful at all in the sense that you're bored or anything like that. So, I will give credit to one of our best directors, Rebecca Teichman, who really does a very good job with whatever she touches, and that's no exception here either. So, but if you like Sarah Ruhl, I guess you're going to like this one a lot. That's my guess. Unless because I don't like Sarah Ruhl, maybe you'll think this is the worst one because I liked it and I don't like her. Who knows? Anyway.
So, Peter, you hit on something that that I was thinking of, too, was that so much of the setup was so unbelievable. And it didn't need to be. It was like she manufactured the drama when it didn't need to be manufactured. And the opening scene when they're discussing Pip before Pip comes in, I just thought that some of that stuff, even the staging of it, where everybody just kept on moving around and posing on the couches in a different position and think, this is so unnatural. And then it just went off the rails for me. I really didn't enjoy this, and I love these folks that are in the cast, and Rebecca Teichman's other work is great. This just wasn't for me. I just wasn't happy with it, and I was really surprised because some of the other great things that have come out of Lincoln Center Theater's New House Theater that and we'll be seeing, like the Oslos and the boxing one that was there last year that I really enjoyed. You know, some really great stuff is coming out of the New House. I didn't think that this was up to par.
Yeah, well, Sarah Ruhl does have her fans, and a lot of them are in institutional theaters because this is her eighth Off-Broadway show, and she will have a ninth come August when she does For Peter Pan on her 70th birthday at Playwrights Horizons. But the first one was back in October of 2006. So in fewer than 11 years, she will have nine productions in New York off-Broadway, and of course she's made it to Broadway as well. So there are people who really believe that this is a major voice in the American theater, and maybe many of you listeners out there are among her fans.
All right. So moving forward, Peter, you also got over to 54 Below a week after Rachel Lilly Rosenblum to see Broadway Bound, the musicals that never came to Broadway. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Jennifer Ashley Tepper and Rob Schneider decided to put on this show, taking songs that had not been heard in New York because the shows closed out of town. So we got something from the Rhythm Club, and it was really nice. Was they actually had slide projections, and we saw what the marquee would have looked like had they come into town. And it was nice that they really had attention to detail here because it was supposed to play at the theater we now know as the August Wilson, but they had the marquee of the Virginia, which is indeed what the theater was known at the time the Rhythm Club was supposed to come in. So And I can see why it would be the logical opening number, because the song was called Hello, 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 Hello. By the way, it was written by Matthew Scarr and Chad Begelin. Chad has since gone on to write a book for Aladdin. And then we had a song about Babe Ruth from a musical that Howard Ashman and Alan Menken were doing. And the song was called Growing Boy. It's from his mother's perspective. And, you know, it occurred to me, I can understand why Howard Ashman would be attracted to a story about Babe Ruth, because both of them came from Baltimore. So I wonder if that had anything to do with it. But How Do You Do I Love You? Now, we do know some songs from How Do You Do I Love You, because they've shown up in Maltby and Shire's review, Starting Here, Starting Now. And I think even there's one in Closer Than Ever. But Just Across the River, you may know that song, certainly comes from How Do You Do I Love You. So Lonnie Ackerman came on. She was in the show originally, and she talked about the fact that because she could make animal noises, that was one of the reasons she was hired, because this, some songs required animal noises. She also, it was also pointed out that the critic who saw the show first said of How Do You Do I Love You, Goodbye, I Hate You. So anyway, what can you do? So we got a song from Rebecca. Yes, Jill Pace, who was to play Rebecca, actually was there and sang a song that started with the famous words, Last Night I Dreamed of Mandalay. So a pretty song, you know, and there was the actual marquee from the Broadhurst projected. I remember when that was up. That was up during the street fair, the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS street fair that happens in September. The marquee was up, but not for long. So it wasn't a power ballad, but it was, you know, quite powerful on its own. Joe Pace also said when the show closed without remotely getting near the Broadhurst, that she took her copy of Rebecca. I think she meant the novel and not the script, but I could be wrong, and dumped it into the Hudson River. I don't know if she really did, but she claimed she did, so who knows. there was a lot of talk about My Beloved Pretty Belle, a show that I think has a phenomenal score, and it was mocked quite a bit, but Leslie Margarita then did I Met a Man, which is a very powerful first act closer than Angela Lansbury originally had. We also heard Thunder and Lightning from Pleasures and Palaces, a Frank Lesser show that was closed in Detroit in 1965. And I'm sorry they didn't do To Be Home Again, which is a much better song. But we got a song from Nerds. Remember Nerds? Just last year. So it was a song in which he spoke a lot in the language of computerese today, you know, a lot of emoticons, a lot of LOLs, that type of thing. So so that was that one. We got a song from All About Us, which is also known as Over and Over, which is also known as The Skin of Our Teeth. Kander and Ebb's musical, Katie Huffman came on and sang a song from that. Bob Cuccioli came there to sing a song from Captain America. And I was really impressed by this song, because I thought it was a good idea for Captain America to sing. And it had a lyric, nobody asked me to lead a parade this year because time has passed and we don't have any heroes anymore. And it really sounded like a humanizing factor, not unlike The Strongest Man in the World, if you know the Superman score from 1966. This is going to be a series, but if they're going to do it as a series, and I'm glad they will, I do think they made a mistake in doing a song from The Baker's Wife, Proud Lady, because that one we know. I mean, well, anybody who's a real musical theater fan certainly knows The Baker's Wife, because it's had two recordings, not just the one that was done after the fact, but also the London cast album was made after Trevor Nunn at auditions kept on hearing one wonderful song after the other that Stephen Schwartz had written for The Baker's Wife, and says, where are these songs from? The Baker's Wife? Again, another good Baker's Wife? I've got to investigate this show. So he investigated. He did it. It wasn't successful, I'm sorry to say. But nobody denies that Stephen Schwartz really wrote a magnificent score for The Baker's Wife. And what was really surprising is up until that point, he had written not one, not two, but three pop rock scores for the theater, all of which were excellent scores. I won't go to bat for The Magic Show as a show, but I do think Stephen Schwartz's work is terrific in it. But suddenly he was in France in another era, and everybody thought, whoa, can he do it? And he showed us he could. So his music is quite quite beautiful for Baker's wife. But I thought under the circumstances, it was a little overexposed for what was going on here. On the other hand, just as so many times, cabaret performers put in a real standard in their act for people who want to hear standards. Maybe that was the rationale here. Let's give them something that some of them know at least a little, so it won't be all unfamiliar material. But I could have used something from some other shows. Lolita, My Love. Lolita, My Love closed out of town with a terrific Alan J. Lerner, John Barry score. So, but they claim it's going to be a series. So as a result, maybe Lolita, My Love is in their plans for the next one or the one after. I hope there are plenty more to come because it was a lot of fun. And the audience had a great time whipping it up at the wonderful talent that was on stage, as well as songs that were better than they might have expected them to be.
You know, I just can't. Every week we talk about 54 Below. Can you imagine what it would be like if we didn't have 54 Below?
Yeah, thank God, because it's also a pretty room as well. And we need cabaret spaces in town. So many have gone away. And those of us who remember places like 88s, you know, feel bad that they don't exist anymore. So, and this is, I do believe, the handsomest cabaret space in town. The lighting is terrific, too, and they certainly maximized the use of the lighting in this show as well. So so it is worth climbing down all those steps, or to be more accurate, climbing them up when you have to at the end of the show.
At the end.
You know, and you're right, after you've probably had a couple of drinks. You know, that's up a very steep and narrow stairway. It seems like a very difficult thing.
You know, there is an elevator.
Are you really?
Yes. Yeah.
Where? Where? Where?
You have to go, if you're coming into 54 Below, you go into that lobby of what looks like an office building right to the right of it.
Yeah.
And then there's an elevator and you take it down and then you could take it back up at the end.
Thank you, Michael.
New York's best kept secrets here. You know?
Thank you, Michael.
Well, I think they like to, you know, not necessarily publicize it so much to leave it for people who really, really, really need it. But, you know, some of us are borderline in that way.
So, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, this type of thing. I wonder if 54 Below didn't exist, where would these outlets be that we would have seen Rachel Lily Rosenblum or Broadway Bound?
Yeah. And you know, as we've discussed, it's so unfortunate that I guess for a lot of complicated reasons, it's really difficult to make a go of those kinds of places. But thank God for 54 Below and also Birdland. That those are two that we have right in the theater district.
Yeah.
You know, long may they flourish. Really,
That's great. So it sounds really exciting, and I'm sorry that I missed this one, but I'm going to have to, keep my eyes open for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So up next, Michael, you got over to Studio 54 to see the Public Theater's production of Sweat, which has moved from off-Broadway at the Public to Broadway now. So tell us about that.
Well, one of the first interesting things about this is that although it's at Studio 54, it is in no way a roundabout production. It seems like the roundabout has belatedly realized that they can make more money as a landlord than as a producer in some cases. Of course, they have not abandoned producing, but as we know, they have been renting out the Sondheim. And now this is not the first non-roundabout production at Studio 54, but that is where it is. So I just think that's an interesting phenomenon. And I guess they're trying to achieve a balance in that way. And I hope that that works for them. Sweat is a very powerful play by Lynn Nottage that was done at the Public, which I saw just not too many months ago and now has moved to Broadway at Studio 54, directed by Kate Worski. And it's set in Reading, Pennsylvania, in two different years. Some scenes take place in 2000 and some in 2008. And basically it's about How this first we meet this group of people who work at a plant, and they all get along really, really well. They're all friends, even though they're different races, and there's none of the conflict that sometimes evolves from that. But then what happens is that the company starts to realize that they can make more money if they start downloading some of the work to Mexico. And so they are planning to what we're told is that what they're planning to do is ask the workers to take a 60% pay cut. If they want to keep their jobs. And so the workers decide not to take the 60% pay cut, and instead they go on strike. And this leads to all kinds of, as you might imagine, really difficult conflict and anger and hatred, and exacerbated by two things. One of the women in the group, a black woman who starts out just being on the floor with the rest of them, she applies for a management position right before all of this shit hits the fan. And so she gets the position. So then when all of this starts to happen, she is now management. And a lot of her friends think of her as a turncoat in not walking out with them and not supporting them. So that's one thing. Then also most of the action actually takes place in a bar where they all hang out. And the guy who works there as, I guess, initially as a bar back, a character named Oscar, it turns out he's from Colombia, played by Carlo Alban. And he finds a flyer posted up somewhere seeking employees for this company. And that's the first sign that they're planning to bust the union and do this, bring in lower wage workers. So he winds up being on the outs with all of these other people, and they some of them view him as a traitor and et cetera, and taking their jobs, taking their livelihoods. Well, it just things spiral from bad to worse, and it ends up with an act of violence that I won't describe, but it's a really very powerful play. I had some problems with it when I saw it at the Public. That didn't bother me as much this time. They're still evident. I think sometimes it's a little soapboxy. Sometimes the characters seem to be speaking for the playwright. And also sometimes I thought that some of the characters, given their positions, their economic and social positions, sometimes they sounded a little too poetic and actually a little too highly educated in terms of vocabulary, but not to such a bad extent, and not enough to really harm the play. I also thought it was a little overlong, but there again, not too much. It's a very, very powerful story. The cast across the board is excellent, but I wanted to call specific notice, in addition to Carlo Alban, to Chris Davis, who plays Chris, and Will Pullen, who plays Jason, who start out as the best of friends, even though, again, one is white and one is black. But then their friendship also winds up being destroyed because of the situation. Also, Joanna Day and James Colby are really excellent in the play. And I think that they're I don't know how well it's going to do on Broadway, a very serious play without any stars, but it does deserve a place on Broadway despite its flaws, and I look forward to seeing how it's received. I hope it's received well, because it deserves to be.
Ironically enough, there was a play downtown a couple of months ago with a very similar plot. Did we ever talk about Dolphins and Sharks? Did anybody see that?
I think you talked about it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very similar idea. And I feel bad for playwright James Anthony Tyler, who must feel that his show set in a photocopy shop has a very similar plot where somebody gets promoted and everybody resents and doesn't work out as violently. But it was a pretty good play. So I do want to give credit to James Anthony Tyler for doing a play in the same vein that that mined a lot of gold in its veins.
Well, certainly the subject matter is inherently very dramatic and certainly all too timely.
Topical, yeah. Yeah, so. Great, so.
Yeah.
Okay, so next up, Peter, you got down to the Public Theater all the way downtown on Lafayette Street and saw Joan of Arc, Into the Fire. So tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a musical by David Byrne, and he wrote book, music, and lyrics. And that's never a good sign, because when people take on all three jobs, when a person takes on all three jobs, the results usually aren't very good. There have been exceptions to the rule, certainly. The Music Man, though, it's been acknowledged that Meredith Willson had a lot more help than we thought at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And most happy fella indeed. Oliver, too, though we found out that Lionel Bart had more help than we had thought. So here's David Byrne's taking on. Now, at some point in the show, you do see projected on the back wall, this is the actual transcript of the trial. So I think it should say book, music, and lyrics by David Byrne, additional dialogue by Joan of Arc, because, you know, they're her words. But anyway, I had the problem I've had with so many rock musicals. And the way I like to put it is, can you picture King Arthur in Camelot wearing a tuxedo? How about the Phantom of the Opera playing a video game? You wouldn't buy these situations any more than you'd accept Tevye's eating a Pop-Tart or Valjean spending the night at a Holiday Inn. You'd emit a little laugh and say, no, they didn't have those back then. And I don't know why anachronisms shouldn't be limited to items, but should include music as well. The early 15th century is more than a half a millennium too early for rock music. But here it is in Joan of Arc and Into the Fire. This latest glorified concert that's occupying a legitimate stage. So the sad thing is the music is really very good, very good indeed. I just don't like that it's out of period. I know that this doesn't bother many people, but it will now and forever bother me. And late in the show, there's a big rave up type number that's worthy of a Baptist minister. And that happens as well. And again, you know, just out of period. And I know it's a style right down to Jones grabbing the mic and wailing into it for her 11 o'clock number. But I, you know, if you're writing this type of music and you do it so well, and I'd love to have an instrumental album. But if you could write this type of music and do it so well, why Joan of Arc? Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. You know, it's an interesting story, and maybe he has something interesting and new to say. No, he doesn't. No, he does not. It's business as usual. It's the Joan of Arc story you heard from George Bernard Shaw, Maxwell Anderson, Anna Wee, Lillian Hellman, Good Time Charlie writers, all that kind of stuff. There's nothing new here, friends. It's the Joan of Arc story. So why not use this music in a more illuminative way? Because he didn't do it here at all. I think he also should have chosen a co-librettist then, who could have taken it into a new direction. I think also he should have had a lyricist because, you know what I'm going to say. So as soon as the curtain goes up, it really no time passes before you hear arc rhymed with heart, non-rhymed with heart, actually. But those of us who enjoyed having our ears tickled with perfect rhymes immediately know this is going to be a long night, even though, you know, it's only 90 minutes with no intermissions. So I don't mind lyrical laziness. I really don't when there's a great idea that you'd lose if you didn't have it. For example, I don't know if any of you know the musical By the Beautiful Sea, but Shirley Booth played a spinster who talked about all the chances she had with men, and she decided she didn't want them, that it was just they were too much trouble or they had problems. And so the song is called I'd Rather Wake Up By Myself. And one of the lyrics, the B section of the song goes, Joe made big dough. His business, he said, was printing. What Joe was printing got him San Quentin. Okay, well, it's San Quentin, as we all know, but that's such a good idea that we pardon it because it's worth having the idea. We wouldn't want not to have it. But there's none of that in Joan of Arc. What's happening here is just bad rhymes because David Byrne doesn't feel like getting out a rhyming dictionary or using it or thinking it's important. But otherwise, you know, it's certainly delivers on being exciting show in the sense that Alex Timbers, one of our most innovative directors, makes very fluid and good stage pictures. And the cast is really good indeed. Almost everybody has to play three roles and join in the ensemble time to time, aside, of course, from the young woman who's playing Joan of Arc, who really is something. Her name is Jo Lampert. And to say that she sings up a storm really isn't enough. She's a tsunami. She sort of looks like she could be Alan Cumming's fraternal twin. And for most of the show, she's dressed as a dominatrix, which is strangely fitting given how she dominates the show. So in this almost all-male cast, almost, you're going to get a big surprise. I'm going to urge anybody who goes not to look at your playbill to see who's in the show beforehand. Do not, because you might as well get the surprise towards the end of the show when suddenly an Oscar nominee makes a cameo appearance. I mean, who expected this lady to come out? So that's good. So again, I'd love to have an instrumental cast album the way they used to make them in the 50s and 60s, where almost every Broadway musical of any worth got albums by people like Lester Lannan and Cy Zentner and what have
Percy
you.
Percy Faith,
yep, the Raycon of singers, all those people. They used to do these albums that just were instrumentals of the show, Skitch Henderson. Not that this album would sound like anything they did, but I would love to hear this music without the lyrics that would drive me crazy and would remind me that David Byrne didn't have anything new to say about Joan of Arc, and because we knew that she did go into the fire.
Okay, so next up, Michael got down to the Transport Group's productions of Picnic and William Inge in Rep. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Picnic and Comeback Little Sheba in Rep, which how often do you see Rep anymore? So that was really interesting. Interestingly enough, I would say that Picnic is a far more successful production than Comeback Little Sheba, even though many of the cast are the same and they're both directed by Jack Cummings, the third. The really interesting thing for me, these shows are being done at the gym at Judson, is that the setup of the playing space is completely different for both plays. First of all, this is one of several productions recently that prominently features unfinished wood as the in place of, I guess you would say, flats. But for Picnic, the audience is on two sides of the action. Basically, it's a very wide but narrow stage that well, narrow at one end and then somewhat wider at the other. It's hard for me to explain, but with all of those wooden flats or slabs or whatever sort of going across the stage diagonally, and in Come Back Little Sheba, those the wood is used only sort of at the edges of the stage, and the action, the audience is seated. It's in the round situation with the action done in the middle. The audience is on all four sides, and there's a lot of furniture in Come Back Little Sheba, whereas in Picnic, there are only a few basically lawn chairs. So I did not expect to see two completely different configurations, especially since the shows are being done literally in rep rather than like 1 week of one and then a week of the other. I saw Picnic on just to be exact here. I saw Picnic on Wednesday night, the 22nd, and then I saw Comeback Little Sheba on Thursday night, the 23rd. So that really surprised me. For whatever reason, I guess casting and also direction. I thought Picnic was really well done. Comeback Little Sheba, not so much. Picnic was so well done that the friend whom I brought, who also had seen the last Broadway revival, said, "I am so glad that you asked me to this, because this production redeemed this play for me." And I don't think that the last Broadway production was terrible, but there was something about it that it didn't quite seem to gel, partly because I think Sebastian Stan, who was Hal in that production, really wasn't right for it. Here we have this fellow named David T. Patterson, who, aside from completely filling out the physical requirements for the role, just really brought a wonderful kind of vulnerability to the character. I think it's necessary for that character that even though he's very boastful and even though he is very much aware of his sexuality and his power over women, I think that he's, you know, he has a lot in his background that makes him extremely insecure and to a certain extent, self-loathing. And all of that came through very well. The rest of the cast in that show was just superb. Mrs. Potts was Heather McRae, Millie Hannah Ellis, Madge Jenna Levine, just really the best, I would say the best Madge I've ever seen. Flo was Michelle Paak, Rosemary Emily Skinner, Alan Rowan Vickers, Irma Jennifer Peach, and John Cariani was Howard. Just really, really well done and very well directed. But Comeback Little Sheba, on the plus side, I very much enjoyed Joseph Kolinsky as Doc. He, I would say, is the best Doc I've ever seen. He did something I've never seen before. In some productions of Sheba, including the film, it starts out with Doc being very, very low key, and you can tell he's a beaten down fellow because he has this horrible alcoholism problem, and he was actually in basically sent away for it for a while, and it's affected his business, it's affected his life, it's just a really bad situation. Joseph Kolinsky at the beginning of the play was not like that at all. He seemed like a guy who was really trying to be happy again. And he was very engaging and smiled a lot and very gregarious. And so later in the play where he really devolves and goes back to drinking, it became extremely, extremely moving and affecting. And when he started going after his wife, Lola, played by Heather McRae, at the end, it was quite harrowing. I think the play is not as well written as Picnic. It is an earlier play, so maybe it took Inge a while to find his footing. It a lot of it is very, very cliched and schematic, and a lot of it is very on the nose. But on the other hand, we do have to remember that, you know, these plays are so old. Back then, I guess people were just beginning to write about subjects like this, alcoholism unhappy marriages of that sort. And then in Picnic, there are themes in Picnic that now we've seen them so many times that sometimes they can seem a little cliched, but you really do have to remember when these things were written. I unfortunately love Heather McRae as an actress, but I did not think she was effective as Lola, partly because she's about 25 years too old for the role. And also she was miscast in some other respects. So I'm not sure exactly. And also, I think the pacing for Picnic was was better than Sheba. For whatever reasons, all of them added up. I did feel that Picnic was much more effective than Sheba. So if our listeners go to both, I would love to hear if anyone else has that same experience that I did.
I've only seen Picnic so far, so I can't do any comparison, but I thought it was a very powerful production of a play that really seems to be saying you have to go with your heart and not with practicalities, because it is a story about this girl who's not from quite the wrong side of the tracks, but certainly is lower middle class. But she has that wonderful asset of having a great body and a great face. And as her mother reminds her, that doesn't last forever. So you've got to strike while that proverbial iron is hot. And there is the rich kid in town who's interested in her, but she just doesn't take to him. And here comes this stud whom she does take to. And should she wind up with this guy who has no money, no prospects, has a police record? I mean, really, you know, I mean, and what does redeem it is when the mother is so upset that the girl might go off with the guy, and the Heather McRae character says to her, could anybody have stopped you? Because she's in an unhappy marriage too. And while, of course, you hate to see your children make the same mistakes you make, that's really what it comes down to. Could anybody have stopped you at that point in time? And the obvious answer is no, because as the boys in the band taught us, in affairs of the heart, there are no rules. And there's nothing you can do about it when the heart takes over the brain.
Well, I mean, those are all excellent points. And I did think that this Jenna Levine, I thought she was just fantastic. I mean, that's a role that I guess a lot of people are always going to think of Kim Novak, but she really made it her own. And she is not in Sheba, by the way. Not everyone repeats for both casts, as I indicated. But I'm so glad that they found her for Madge. I thought she was just fantastic.
All right. So to wrap up for this morning, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to Deborah Grace Weiner, who is the artistic director of the 92nd Street Y Lyrics and Lyricists series. And Michael, you got down to see Baby, Dream Your Dream, Dorothy Fields and the Women of the American Songbook. So tell us about that.
Well, it was a really fantastic program. For whatever reason, I had not been to Lyrics and Lyricists in quite some time. I'm glad that I returned for this. It was only five performances, Saturday, March 18th through Monday, March 20th. Deborah put together a really fantastic program and hosted it beautifully. The performers, Marilyn May, Kenita Miller, Nancy Opel, Margot Seibert, and Emily Skinner, every one of them fantastic. I saw Emily Skinner in this concert about two or three nights before I saw her in Picnic. And if I didn't know it was the same person, I would never have known, partly because of a different wig, but just she just really fulfilled the requirements of you know, these very different roles. And she really was amazing. I am a much bigger fan of Emily Skinner than I've ever been before after seeing her in these two very different assignments over a few days. There was a great little band, Aaron Hike on reeds, Scott Harrell trumpet, Jay Leonard bass, James Saporito drums, and the pianist and music director, arranger, orchestrator was John Otto, who used to work with Rosemary Clooney, and he did one of the best jobs of the evening. His arrangements were absolutely fantastic. This was a very instructive and informative and also moving reminder of the fact that even though the number of women songwriters percentage-wise, you know, has been until now relatively quite small for a number of reasons that were discussed in the program, what does exist is of the highest quality. We have not only Dorothy Fields, who wrote fabulous lyrics with any number of composers, but we also have Dana Suisse, Anne Rennell, Betty Comden, let's see, Dori Previn, then moving up more recently, Carolyn Lee, Mary Rogers, of course. One point that was made is that the number of female songwriters does increase somewhat when you add people like Billie Holiday. Now, I think it's fair to say that few people think of Billie Holiday primarily as a songwriter, but she did co-write God Bless the Child, one of her biggest hits. And if she only co-wrote that, you know, that's a major achievement. Then, of course, there's Peggy Lee, who was also famous, much more famous as a singer, but also fairly well known as a songwriter. And then we have people like who were represented in this program, like Carole King. When you add all of those in, it's the performer writers as well. It really becomes an even more impressive situation. And it was the choices of songs were fantastic. As I said, the band and the musical direction were fabulous, and the narration and the whole construction of the program. So I'm glad I'm back at Lyrics and Lyricists, and I intend to keep on going as often as I can.
All right. So that is great, and I look forward to all the other stuff that happens at 92nd Street Y, and we'll try to bring you that before it happens, as we did with the Deborah Grace Winer interview that we did a few weeks back. All right, so that wraps it up for today. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, there are many ways to listen to us. One of the ways is the iHeartRadio app, Google Play app, or anywhere that you can listen to finer podcasts, including the Stitcher app. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week's trivia?
Well, the question was, what was the first Tony-winning musical to include the musical scale, the one that starts with Do in one of its songs? Give the name of the song, too. Okay. Well, seven people, of course, wrote in and said, you can't mean The Sound of Music. It's got to be something other than that. I mean, we all know that Do a Deer certainly made an appearance in that song. Deb Popple said, it occurred to me you might be thinking about Shapoopy. Yes, indeed. That's exactly what I meant. There's a do-re-mi sequence in the middle of the lyric of Shapoopy from The Music Man, which indeed was a Tony-winning musical a few years before Sound of Music. So, but, she added, if so, while the song does say do, re, mi, fa, so, and so on, it's not actually the major scale implied by your question. The seventh scale degree is flatted, so it's actually the Mixolydian mode. Well, I don't know about you. I don't know about you listeners out there, but this was certainly news to me. But anyway, so credit to Deb for not only guessing Shapoopy, but also for enlightening us about the seventh degree scale being flatted and the Mixolydian mode. So,
you know, I'm just thinking I could be wrong, but the do re mi syllables are not used, but I think. I think On Your Toes has the scale.
Not a Tony-winning musical.
Oh, okay. All right. My mistake.
Here's the new one. What 1960s Tony-nominated musical, the first Tony-nominated musical this composer-lyricist would have, but hardly the last Tony-nominated musical that this composer-lyricist would have, had a lyric that referenced two Rodgers and Hammerstein songs in one line? Seriously, out of eight words, five were originally Hammerstein's. So what's the song, the show, and the composer-lyricist's name?
All right. So if you know that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I don't want to go to heaven. Don't want to go to hell.